Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
But I'm also trying to make an argument to men that their own sense of fulfillment in the world will be enhanced if they can detach to the degree possible from the patriarchal training that we men get on, you know, as we always say, how to be a man. And what I'm arguing, as feminists have long argued, is there are different ways that men can live that are much more fulfilling to men, not only safer for women and girls.
That's the voice of author and educator Dr. Robert Jensen. On this week's show, we speak to Dr. Jensen about his latest book, The End of Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. So stay tuned.
Dr. Robert Jensen is a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, and we reached him in Texas. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thanks, Sylvia. It's always great to be on your show. I really appreciate it.
Now, when we think about patriarchy, it's sort of like the fish, you know, thinking about water. Mm-hmm. It just seems to me it's the ocean we swim in. What prompted you to write a book about ending patriarchy and specifically addressing the role the men play in this journey?
Well, it's interesting. I'm nearly 60 years old, and this is a subject that I've spent about half my life on now. When I was 30 years old, I went back to graduate school, and I was lucky enough to have the time and the resources to think about the world in a deeper way. And one of the first things I started thinking about was the relationship of male and female, gender, sex politics. And that led pretty quickly to a feminist critique of patriarchy, of this institutionalized male dominance. And once we put that subject on the table and we use that term, it's pretty, I think, easy to recognize that basically all of the world is patriarchal. That is, that although individual societies will differ dramatically, that this notion of institutionalized male dominance is an accurate account of every society. So take the United States, where I live. I would argue it's a patriarchal society. Compare it to a society like Saudi Arabia, also patriarchal. Well, those are very different societies, of course, but there are some common themes about how men claim control over women, and especially women's reproductive power and women's sexuality, which have always been the core of patriarchal societies, control over women's bodies, essentially. Well, once you start looking at society that way, all sorts of things become very clear. And for me, this was all part of coming to understand the world in a different way, understanding specific aspects of the world, most notably the pornography industry, which is what I began my academic career studying. And one other important point about looking at gender politics through this critique of patriarchy is patriarchy is a hierarchy in which men claim the right to dominate women. But it's clearly not the only hierarchy in the world. There are hierarchies based on race and ethnicity, hierarchies based on wealth, hierarchies based on nation of origin. All sorts of things structure the domination and subordination that goes on in our world. And it's not just gender and sex, obviously. But I think for me, when I started studying patriarchy, it made me more aware of, more open to critiques of other forms of domination and subordination. So for me, the feminist critique of patriarchy, especially what we tend to call the radical feminist critique of patriarchy, was not only a way for me to understand sex gender politics, it was a way for me to start thinking more critically about the whole world.
I'd like to begin where you start your book. You say, let's follow your fears. And that you point out that in our contemporary world, you know, is formed and informed by a myriad of hierarchies. And you talk about mm-hmm. white supremacy, imperialism, capitalism. How do we self-locate then within this domination subordination dynamic that seems to co-create all of our interactions with each other, with, you know, not just between men and women, but among nations, among people, among races?
Yeah. Well, the first thing is to recognize that if you step back and start thinking about it, it's kind of frightening at first when we realize how much of our world and our interactions in that world are based on domination and subordination dynamics. And while each one of those, you know, gender is not the same as race, is not the same as national origin, is not the same as capitalism, all of these are different forms of hierarchy. But they do have one thing in common, which is that they want to get people to believe that all of this is somehow natural. So let's take the patriarchal relationships between men and women. A lot of people will say, well, that's not politics. That's not about power and the struggle for control. That's just the way men and women are. When in fact, of course, that's not the case. For most of our evolutionary history, human beings did not live in patriarchal societies based on institutionalized male dominance. So, you know, that's the key for people in power, to get people who are disempowered to believe that somehow all of this is natural, because if it's natural, then it can't be changed. If you look at the beginnings of white supremacy, of course, that was all based on the claim that Europeans, people we now call white, were naturally superior to all other people of the world. That, of course, no one really articulates that justification anymore. But there is still this idea in the racial dynamics in the United States that somehow, you know, white people are on top because we're just naturally harder working or smarter or whatever. We don't say it out loud so much anymore, but a lot of people, I think, still believe that. Take capitalism, the system of economic domination. Well, you know, rich people love to believe that they're rich because they're just harder working and smarter, and it's natural. You can't do anything about it, that in a competitive economy, there will always be people with a lot of stuff and people with not so much stuff. Well, none of this is natural. It's all a product of human decisions about how to structure our political and economic lives. And if it's not natural, it means it can be changed. So the common denominator here is that we have to resist any attempt to claim that any system of domination and subordination is somehow natural and beyond human intervention. It's all open to us changing if we have the political will to do so.
I love that you talk about how things are naturalized, and I would argue how we are invisibilized, you know, by processes that are both economic, political, culturally so-called defining. So let's talk a little bit about how a culture then is created, because in so many ways people say, well, that's our culture, you know, it's a masculine driven culture, and this is just the way we are. So, but if this is not natural, if culture is what we're making each day, how has patriarchy become the, you know, predominant way of interaction?
Question of patriarchy, we're talking about several thousand years of human history, going back to the beginnings of agriculture and the beginnings of, you know, what we call civilization, which is ironically the beginning of many of our contemporary problems, where people could stockpile food, they could acquire the wealth that comes from that and the power. All of that is, you know, part of the last 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 years of human history. And it's taken different forms over time. So clearly, you know, the contemporary United States is not like, you know, the Babylonian Empire or something. In our world, all of these things are, of course, refracted through a deep history of white supremacy and contemporary capitalism. And so when we look at the United States and make the claim it's a patriarchal society, often people will first say, well, geez, you know, we just had a presidential election and a woman almost got elected. How could you call it a patriarchal society when you have women now at the competitive at the top levels of politics and business? Well, you know, if that were the measure that some small number of people can compete at that level, then we'd have to say the United States is also no longer a white supremacist nation, because after all, we elected a black president. But nobody would make that claim, because we realize white supremacy still endures. The same with patriarchy. Now, the peculiar feature of contemporary patriarchy in the United States is, as women have won more space in places like government and business and education. That is to say, you know, there are, for instance, I teach at the University of Texas at Austin, and women have opportunities here today that they didn't have when I was born in 1958. So that's all to the good. There's been an expansion of women's ability to participate in institutions. But the question is twofold. One is have those institutions changed to become overarchingly more progressive, for instance? That is, has the presence of women, for instance, made capitalism more humane? Well, there's no evidence of that. So we can see that women are allowed into spaces, but the fundamental structure of society hasn't changed very much. The second question is about, as women have made gains in some areas, where has there been a kind of pushback from patriarchal culture? And the place we see that most intensely is in sexuality, especially the way these subjects that I've been studying a long time, pornography, prostitution, what I generally call the sexual exploitation industries, the ways that men routinely buy and sell women's bodies for sexual pleasure. Well, there's been a huge expansion of the sexual exploitation industries and a normalizing of them. So pornography, for instance, which was always considered a marginal aspect of contemporary society, is now readily available, easily accessible, and by a lot of people treated as just a normal part of society. Yet if you look at the pornography industry and the images it produces, they're deeply misogynistic. They're based on men's sexual domination of women often, right? So we see that we've lost ground in those areas. And ever since the 1990s, in a very well-known book called Backlash by an American author, Susan Faludi, who argued that as women did make gains through the feminist movement in the 1970s and in the 80s, there was this backlash. And women were often in the sexual realm then even more intensely objectified. So if you look at the routine objectification of women, that is the routine way in which women are presented to men as objectified bodies for their male pleasure, well, there's been a dramatic expansion and intensification of that in the last 30 years. So, you know, life is always complicated, but when we say the United States remains a patriarchal society, we're not saying it's, you know, it's patriarchal in the same way, you know, other societies may be, or the same way the U.S. was 100 years ago when women couldn't vote and women were often considered the property of their husbands. We're not saying we haven't made progress. We're saying we have to look at the bigger picture.
I often think about, you know, the impact that one thing has on something else. So growing up in Latin America, I grew up during the time of war. And so it was always the immediate call was to survive, you know, just to survive the war. And there was really little space to think about the roles between men and women and the role, you know, the way violence kind of shaped our psyche of what we consider possible and what was outside those realms. So can we talk a little bit about the impact that this, in particularly pornography, for instance, you know, the mm-hmm. level of violence that this imposes on the bodies of women has creates and the impact that that has on all our other struggles? Because we, you know, you may have someone who's very committed to ending, you know, capitalism as a system of domination of economic inequality, but not quite clear of why, you know, sexual oppression is also something to be attended to.
Right, right. So, you know, we all, or I think at least in theory, we all can agree that progressive political projects have to go together in some sort of unity. That is, we can't say, well, let's just work on the problem of capitalism and we'll deal with racism and sexism later. But there's no feasible way to do that. You've got to make the struggle about all these systems of domination and subordination. Now, individual people will perhaps be more focused on one or the other, obviously. But we have to have some sense that we're all going forward in that spirit. And of course, that doesn't always happen. It's historically the case that on the male-dominated left, at least again, I usually speak only of the United States, the society I know best, men have given lip service to the problem of patriarchy and the need to take seriously sexism and violence against women, but then not acted on that. And there are real ramifications of that. For one thing, let's just take the basic issue of men's violence against women, which every woman in the world knows something about, either from direct experience with it or the experience of close friends, or merely understanding that one lives under the threat of that violence. I do not know a woman in the world who does not think about the threat of sexual violence pretty much on an ongoing basis. It constrains the way people move in the world sometimes. All right. Well, if you're in a left organizing project and no one takes seriously that threat of violence, it's going to impede the ability of women to participate in various other kinds of projects. So all of these things are both sort of theoretically connected, and there are very, very basic ways they impact day-to-day life for people. On the question of pornography and what we could just call the hypersexualization of women in this culture, not only in pornography, but in other forms of pop culture as well. Several authors, for instance, my friend Gail Dines has written very compelling material on this, is that women are consistently offered a choice. You can either conform to the conventional standards of what a hypersexualized woman is supposed to look like. That is, if you're going out to the club for the evening, there's certain expectations of how you'll dress and present yourself. Or you have a choice of being invisible. That is, if you don't conform to those standards, you'll be largely invisible to men. And for heterosexual women who are involved in social networks and dating, that's a pretty difficult choice. Do you want to conform to a patriarchal image of women, or do you want to be invisible? Well, being invisible is pretty hard in the world, so it's a lonely place to be. So these are the very real-world choices that women face. Now, you know, we've been talking about the negative effects of patriarchy on women, and that's important. You know, the subtitle of the book is Radical Feminism for Men, and so part of what I also do is argue that while men may benefit in some short-term material ways from patriarchy, that the trade-offs are really not worth it, that patriarchy presents very serious threats to women, but it also constrains men. So as I always say, in addition to making the argument from justice, that is for men to resist patriarchy and endorse and embrace feminism is the right thing to do, you can get there on the argument from justice. I also want to point out that there's an argument from self-interest that our lives will be enhanced if we can somehow transcend the patriarchal training and try to live in the world differently. So, you know, both things are important. Of course, the threats to women and girls are the most important focus, because those threats are very real and literally are life-threatening. But I'm also trying to make an argument to men that their own sense of fulfillment in the world will be enhanced if they can detach to the degree possible from the patriarchal training that we men get on, you know, as we always say, how to be a man. And what I'm arguing, as feminists have long argued, is there are different ways that men can live that are much more fulfilling to men, not only safer for women and girls.
Can we talk a little bit about the impact that sustaining this level of violence against one group co-creates, you know, almost strengthens, you know, the imperialism, almost strengthens the other forms of domination and oppression that we face?
Yeah. First of all, let me just add a footnote. You said 1 out of 6 women will experience some kind of violence. And that statistic is actually for the experience of what is legally defined as rape. So, you know, the numbers vary somewhat, and I think it's a very conservative number. But let's say, you know, about 17-18% of women in the United States will experience a violent act that legally meets the definition of rape. Well, if you expand that and talk about not just those things that are sexual violence under the law, but talk about all of the unwanted sexual interventions into women's lives, forms of sexual harassment and coercive behavior on dating and harassment on the street, all of those kinds of things. I use the term sexual intrusion to capture that whole experience, right? Unwanted sexual attention at some point in one's life. Well, I think 100% of women experience that. So if we confine it just to those acts that legally meet the definition of rape, we're still talking about an enormous number of women. But if we expand to the broader notion of sexual intrusion, then basically we're talking about all women have this experience. Now, as you point out, this patriarchal quest for domination, which in the terms we're talking about is the domination of men over women, has other consequences. It's an especially violent form of interaction. And violence is not merely contained to gender relations. Now, human beings are capable of violence. You and I are capable of violence. But we're not talking about just the fact that human beings can be mean sometimes or can strike out. We're talking about a system that endorses and, in fact, often glorifies that violence. And patriarchy does glorify that domination through violence. And that, not surprisingly, shows up in the way we resolve conflicts in all sorts of ways, including conflicts at the level of nation states. So if you think about the story we hear about the military in the United States, it is a very patriarchal story, not only in the sense that most of the people in the armed services are men, but in the sense that it glorifies that use of violence to resolve disputes. It doesn't just say occasionally violence is inevitable. It says violence is a kind of glorious way to control the world. And of course, in this modern high-tech world, that violence is not just individuals engaged in direct combat. It's with weapons that can literally destroy the world. So one of the things about patriarchy is that we see its effects not only in the most intimate spaces in our lives, in relationships with partners, for instance. We also see it at the global level, at the kinds of madness that are let loose in the world and can literally, quite literally at this point in human history, potentially result in the destruction of the entire world. And that's also, in a sense, patriarchal in nature.
We are speaking with Dr. Robert Jensen and his latest book, End the Patriarchy, Radical Feminism for Men. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the role of rape, because in your book you write that rape is both nominally illegal, so we have some definition that, you know, what consists of rape, but it's also at the same time completely normal. And how does this interplaying how men, you know, conscious men out there who are very committed to ending rape, you know, participate at the same time while denouncing and are also participant?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So no one would stand up in contemporary America today or most any other society and say rape is a good thing. It's a criminal act, but it's a more complicated story than that. So the first question might be, you know, how often do we prosecute people convicted or who do rape? And the answer is very rarely. So we have something that's against the law, but is not treated in the same way that we treat lots of other criminal acts. But beyond that, it's not only that it's a rarely prosecuted crime, it's that in lots of ways, men are actually encouraged to be sexually aggressive. By that, I don't mean, again, that, you know, men are told it's okay to go rape women, but men are encouraged to be players. You know, the best thing you can be when you're a young man and heterosexual is to be a man who gets a lot of women. And there's a lot of talk in all male spaces about, you know, getting women and how to get women and coercing women and pressuring women. There's a lot of encouragement to get women, to be a player, to be a real man in those terms by pushing. And if you encourage that kind of attitude, and if you encourage men to look at women as sexual objects who exist for their pleasure, that inevitably is going to lead to sexual violence. Again, not because people are told to do it, but because it's a predictable outcome of the values we hold. And that's why I argue in the book, following many, many years of radical feminist critique, that until we deal with the problem of this very toxic definition of masculinity, masculinity that is defined as control, masculinity that is defined as conquest, which of course leads to aggression, that until we can challenge that conception of masculinity, sexual violence is going to be a predictable consequence of the way we socialize men. Now, The flip side, of course, is we also socialize women often to be passive, to treat men as, you know, the leader, and to see themselves as having value primarily for ways in which they are attractive to men. Again, I'm not saying people, you know, train their little girls to see themselves as sexual objects, but we're talking about the way the whole society works, how pop culture works, how media works, and how the unspoken realities work. So from a radical feminist perspective, it's not only focused on the problem of sexual violence, but focused on that underlying domination subordination dynamic we've been talking about, and how that's made real in everyday life, made real in culture, and the predictable consequences of that, which are these epidemic levels of violence against women.
In your book, you talk that rape is really about power. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the role of prostitution in a capitalist society, because we often, you know, people always say it's the oldest profession, you know, and one of my interviewers said it's the oldest oppression.
Yeah. So, you know, first of all, to go back to that phrase, rape is about power. There are people in the women's movement who have argued that rape is best understood as about an assertion of power, not about sex and sexual attraction and sexual gratification. But I think that misses the way that rape is about both things. That, yes, rape is a way that men feel powerful over women, but rape is also a way that men get sex from women. I think it's too simple to say that rape is about power, not sex. It's about both. And that reminds us how in everyday life, even acts that don't meet the legal definition of rape have a kind of rape-like component to them. And if anybody doubts that, just, you know, listen to women testify about their dating experiences. I have spoken with many, many women who say that there have been certain, you know, situations in their personal life where there would not have been a legally defined rape, but that the sexual interaction with somebody on a date felt rape-like, felt like the man was being aggressive and coercive and leading to sexual interaction the woman might not have wanted, but she was afraid of. All sorts of things happen in this world that really do force us to look at the underlying dynamic between men and women. But as far as prostitution goes, yes, there's a deep divide within feminism. There are wings of the feminist movement that assert that prostitution is a choice women make, and that in a liberated society, women would have that choice. But the radical feminist position that I work from has long critiqued prostitution, saying that within a patriarchal society where women often face real constraints on their actions, the so-called choice to rent your body for the sexual pleasure of men is really not a meaningful choice unless there are lots of other options. There's a lot of debate about this. It goes even to the question of terms we use. So people on my side of the fence tend to talk about prostitution, women who are prostituted, and folks on the other side tend to talk about sex workers as if prostitution is just another form of work. Well, there are a lot of debates about, you know, the real experiences of women in prostitution, and that's all important. But I always want to go back and ask the question, what is the nature of a society in which one group of people, that is women, are defined as being purchasable? You know, they're the kind of people who can be bought and sold for sex. Now, clearly, we should recognize that, you know, boys and men are also prostituted, that there is prostitution in that context as well. But the overwhelming amount of prostitution is, of course, men buying women. And that is the sort of foundation of it. And I always ask a simple question. Is it possible to imagine a decent human community in which there's real gender equality? That is, a human community in which men and women are truly equal in the eyes of society. Is it possible to imagine such a society when one group of people, primarily women, can be bought and sold for the sexual pleasure of the other group, men? I have a hard time imagining a society with gender justice in which prostitution would exist. And in fact, I think if we had a society with gender justice, the question wouldn't even arise. No one would think about buying and selling bodies for sex. Now, you know, I can't prove that, but I think there's a compelling argument to be made that prostitution and other forms of commercialized sexual exploitation are inconsistent with a decent human community that takes gender justice seriously. Now, I know a lot of people disagree, and there is, as I said, a very intense debate, not only in the culture more generally, but within feminism as well, about this question. And I don't want to pretend that the point of view I'm articulating is the only one. But that said, I think that we do have to ask that fundamental question. Are we ever going to achieve a decent human community when people are bought and sold for sexual pleasure? I have a hard time imagining such a thing.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Dr. Robert Jensen is a professor in the School of Journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, and we reached him in Texas. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. It's always such a pleasure to speak with you, Sylvia. Thanks.
Thank you. Take care.
Okay. Bye-bye.
We've come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is an internationally syndicated weekly program made available through campus and community stations and available out to the world at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Visit Latin Waves Media to hear previous shows, to access resources, or support our efforts towards social change via community project engagement. Thank you, and bye for now.